Teft entered the barrack at midday. Ducking into the shadowy interior was like entering a cave. He glanced to the left, where the other wounded usually slept. They were all outside at the moment, getting some sun. All five were doing well, even Layton. Teft passed the lines of rolled-up blankets at the sides of the room, walking to the back of the chamber, where Kaladin lay.
Poor man. What's worse, being sick near to death, or having to stay all the way back here, away from the light?
It was necessary. Bridge 4 walked a precarious line. They had been allowed to cut Kaladin down, and so far nobody had tried to stop them from caring for him. Practically the entire army had heard Sadeas give Kaladin to the Stormfather for judgment. Gaz had come to see Kaladin, then had snorted to himself in amusement. He'd likely told his superiors that Kaladin would die. Men didn't live long with wounds like those. Yet Kaladin hung on. Soldiers were going out of their way to try to get a peek at him. His survival was incredible. People were talking in camp, given to the Stormfather for judgment, then spared. A miracle. Sadeas wouldn't like that. How long would it be before one of the Light Eyes decided to relieve their Bright Lord of the problem? Sadeas couldn't take any overt action, not without losing a great deal of credibility, but a quiet poisoning or suffocation would abbreviate the embarrassment. So Bridge 4 kept Kaladin as far from outside eyes as possible, and they always left someone with him. Always.
Storming man.
Teft knelt beside the feverish patient in his tousled blankets, eyes closed, face sweaty, body bound with a frightful number of bandages. Most were stained red. They didn't have the money to change them often. Scar kept watch currently. The short, strong-faced man sat at Kaladin's feet.
How is he?
He seems to be getting worse, Teft. I heard him mumble about dark shapes thrashing and telling him to keep back. He opened his eyes. He didn't seem to see me, but he saw something. I swear it.
Death spread. Collect preserve us. I'll take a turn. You go get something to eat.
Scar stood looking pale. It would crush the other's spirit for Kaladin to survive the high storm, then die of his wounds. Scar shuffled from the room, shoulders slumped. Teft watched Kaladin for a long while, trying to gather his thoughts, his emotions.
Why now? Why here? After so many have watched and waited, you come here?
But of course, Teft was getting ahead of himself. He didn't know for certain. He only had assumptions and hopes. No, not hopes. Fears. He had rejected the Envisagers, and yet here he was. He fished in his pocket and pulled out 3 small diamond spheres. It had been a long, long while since he'd saved anything of his wages, but he'd held on to these, thinking, worrying. They glowed with stormlight in his hand.
Do I really want to know?
Gritting his teeth, Teft moved closer to Kaladin's side, looking down at the unconscious man's face.
You bastard. You storming bastard. You took a bunch of hanged men and lifted them up just enough to breathe. Now you're going to leave them? I won't have it, you hear? I won't!
He pressed the spheres into Kaladin's hand, wrapping the limp fingers around them, then laying the hand on Kaladin's abdomen. Then, Teft sat back on his heels. What would happen? All the Envisagers had were stories and legends.
Fool's tales. Idle dreams.
Of course, nothing happened.
You're as big a fool as any, Teft.
He reached for Kaladin's hand. Those spheres would buy a few drinks. The glow in his hand faded. Teft froze, eyes widening. Wisps of light began to rise from Kaladin's body. It was faint, but there was no mistaking that glowing white stormlight streaming off his frame. It was as if Kaladin had been bathed in sudden heat, and his very skin steamed. Kaladin's eyes snapped open, and they leaked light too, faintly colored amber. The trailing wisps of light began to twist around the exposed cuts on his chest. A few of them pulled together and knit themselves up. Then, it was gone. The light of those tiny chips expended. Kaladin's eyes closed, and he relaxed. His wounds were still bad, his fevers still raging, but some color had returned to his skin. The puffy redness around several cuts had diminished.
My God, Almighty, cast from heaven to dwell in our hearts, it is true.
He bowed his head to the rock floor, squeezing his eyes shut, tears leaking from their corners.
Why now? Why here? And in the name of all heaven, why me?
He knelt for 100 heartbeats, counting, thinking, worrying. Eventually, he pulled himself to his feet and retrieved the spheres, now done, from Kaladin's hand. He needed to trade them for spheres with light in them. Then he could return and let Kaladin drain those as well.
I'll have to be careful. A few spheres each day, but not too many.
If the boy healed too quickly, it would draw too much attention.
And I need to tell the Invisagers.
The Invisagers were gone. Dead because of what he had done. If there were others, he had no idea how to locate them.
Who will I tell? Who will believe me? Kaladin himself probably didn't understand what he was doing. No, best to keep it quiet.
At least until he could figure out what to do about it.
Within a heartbeat, Alizarov was there, crossing a distance that would have taken more than 4 months to travel by foot. Another folk tale, this one recorded in Among the Dark-Eyed by Callanum, page 102. Stories of instantaneous travel and the Oath Gates pervade these tales.
Shallan's hand flew across the drawing board, moving as if of its own accord. Charcoal scratching, sketching, smudging, thick lines first like trails of blood left by a thumb drawn across rough granite. Tiny lines like scratches made by a pin. She sat in her closet-like stone chamber in the conclave. No windows, no ornamentation on the granite walls, just the bed, her trunk, the nightstand, and the small desk that doubled as a drawing table. A single ruby brome cast a bloody light on her sketch. Usually, to produce a vibrant drawing, she had to consciously memorize a scene, a blink, freezing the world, imprinting it into her mind. She hadn't done that during Yasna's annihilation of the thieves. She'd been too frozen by horror or morbid fascination. Despite that, she could see each of those scenes in her mind just as vividly as if she'd deliberately memorized them. And these memories didn't vanish when she drew them. She couldn't rid her mind of them. Those deaths were burned into her. She sat back from her drawing board, hand shaking, the picture before her an exact charcoal representation of the suffocating nightscape, squeezed between alley walls, a tortured figure of flame rising toward the sky. At that moment, its face still held its shape, shadow eyes wide and burning lips agape. Yasna's hand was toward the figure as if warding or worshipping. Shallan drew her charcoal-stained fingers to her chest, staring at her creation. It was one of dozens of drawings she'd done during the last few days. The man turned into fire, the other frozen into crystal, the two transmuted to smoke. She could only draw one of those two fully. She'd been facing down the alleyway to the east. Her drawings of the fourth man's death were of smoke rising, clothing already on the ground. She felt guilty for being unable to record his death, and she felt stupid for that guilt. Logic did not condemn Yasna. Yes, the princess had gone willingly into danger, but that didn't remove responsibility from those who had chosen to hurt her. The men's actions were reprehensible. Shallan had spent the days poring through books on philosophy, and most ethical frameworks exonerated the princess. But Shallan had been there. She'd watched those men die. She'd seen the terror in their eyes, and she'd felt terrible. Hadn't there been another way?
Kill or be killed.
That was the philosophy of Starkness. It exonerated Yasna.
Actions are not evil. Intent is evil. And Yasna's intent had been to stop men from harming others.
That was the philosophy of Purpose. It lauded Yasna.
Morality is separate from the ideals of men. It exists whole somewhere, to be approached, but never truly understood by the mortal.
The philosophy of ideals. It claimed that removing evil was ultimately moral, and so in destroying evil men, Yasna was justified.
Objective must be weighed against methods. If the goal is worthy, then the steps taken are worthwhile, even if some of them, on their own, are reprehensible.
The philosophy of aspiration. It, more than any, called Yasna's actions ethical. Shallan pulled the sheet from her drawing board and tossed it down beside the others scattered across her bed. Her fingers moved again, clutching the charcoal pencil, beginning a new picture on the blank sheet strapped in place on the table, unable to escape. Her theft nagged her as much as the killings did. Ironically, Yasna's demand that Shallan study moralistic philosophy forced her to contemplate her own terrible actions. She'd come to Carbranth to steal the Fabriel, then use it to save her brothers and their house from massive debt and destruction. Yet in the end, this wasn't why Shallan had stolen the Soulcaster. She'd taken it because she was angry with Yasna. If the intentions were more important than the action, then she had to condemn herself. Perhaps the philosophy of aspiration, which stated that objectives were more important than the steps taken to achieve them, would agree with what she'd done, but that was the philosophy she found most reprehensible. Shallan sat here sketching, condemning Yasna. But Shallan was the one who had betrayed a woman who had trusted her and taken her in. Now, she was planning to commit heresy with the Soulcaster by using it, although she was not an Ardent. The Soulcaster itself lay in the hidden part of Shallan's trunk. 3 days, and Yasna had said nothing about the disappearance. She wore the fake each day. She said nothing, acted no differently. Maybe she hadn't tried soul casting. Almighty send that she didn't go out and put herself into danger again, expecting to be able to use the Fabriel to kill men who attacked her. Of course, there was one other aspect of that night that Shallan had to think of. She carried a concealed weapon that she hadn't used. She felt foolish for not even thinking of getting it out that night. But she wasn't accustomed to. Shallan froze, realizing for the first time what she'd been drawing. Not another scene from the alleyway, but a lavish room with a thick ornamented rug and swords on the walls, a long dining table set with a half-eaten meal, and a dead man in fine clothing, lying face first on the floor, blood pooling around him. She jumped back, tossing aside the charcoal, then crumpled up the paper. Shaking, she moved over and sat down on the bed among the pictures. Dropping the crumpled drawing, she raised her fingers to her forehead, feeling the cold sweat there. Something was wrong with her, drawings. She had to get out, escape the death, the philosophy, and the questions. She stood and hurriedly strode into the main room of Yasna's quarters. The princess herself was away researching, as always. She hadn't demanded that Shallan come to the Vale today. Was that because she realized that her ward needed time to think alone? Or was it because she suspected Shallan of stealing the Soulcaster and no longer trusted her? Shallan hurried through the room. It was furnished only with the basics provided by King Taravagian. Shallan pulled open the door to the hallway and nearly ran into a master servant who had been reaching up to knock.
Brightness, apologies, but one of your span reeds is flashing.
The woman held up the reed, affixed on the side with a small blinking ruby.
Thank you.
She, like Yasna, left their span reeds in the care of servants because she was often away from her rooms and was likely to miss any attempt to contact her. Still flustered, she was tempted to leave the thing and continue on her way. However, she did need to speak with her brothers, Nan Balat particularly, and he'd been away the last few times she'd contacted home. She took the span reed and closed the door. She didn't dare return to her rooms, with all of those sketches accusing her, but there was a desk and a span reed board in the main room. She sat there, then twisted the ruby.
Shallan, are you comfortable?
It was a code phrase meant to indicate to her that it was indeed Nan Balat, or at least his betrothed, on the other side.
My back hurts and my wrist itches.
It was the other half of the code phrase.
I'm sorry I missed your other communications. I had to attend a feast in Father's name. It was with Sur Kumar, so it wasn't really something I could miss, despite the day of traveling each way.
It's all right. I have the item.
The reed was still for a long moment.
Praise the heralds! Oh, Shallan, you've done it. You are on your way back to us, then? How can you use the span reed on the ocean? Are you in port?
I haven't left.
What? Why?
Because it would be too suspicious. Think about it, Nanbalat. If Yasna tries the item and finds it broken, she might not immediately decide that she's been had. That changes if I've suddenly and suspiciously left for home. I have to wait until she's made the discovery and see what she does next. If she realizes that her Fabriel was replaced with a fake, then I can deflect her toward other culprits. She's already suspicious of the Ardentia. If, on the other hand, she assumes that her Fabriel has broken somehow, I'll know we're free.
The question she'd been expecting came next.
And if she immediately assumes that you did it? Shallan, what if you can't deflect her suspicion? What if she orders a search of your chambers and finds the hidden compartment?
Then it is still better for me to be here. Balat, I have learned much about Yasna Kolin. She is incredibly focused and determined. She will not let me escape if she thinks I have robbed her. She will hunt me down, and she will use all of her resources to exact retribution. We'd have our own king and high princes on our property in days, demanding that we turn over the Fabriel. Stormfather, I'll bet Yasna has contacts in Yakaved that she could reach before I got back. I'd find myself in custody the moment I landed. Our only hope is to deflect her. If that doesn't work, better for me to be here and suffer her wrath quickly. Likely she would take the Soulcaster and banish me from her sight. If we make her work and chase after me, though, she can be very ruthless, Balat. It would not go well for us.
When did you get so good at logic, small one? I see that you've thought this through. Better than I have, at least. But Shallan, our time is running out.
I know. You said you could hold things together for a few more months. I ask you to do that. Give me 2 or 3 weeks at least to see what Yasna does. Besides, while I'm here, I can look into how the thing works. I haven't found any books that give hints, but there are so many here. Maybe I just haven't found the right one yet.
Very well. A few weeks. Be careful, small one. The men who gave Father his Fabriel visited again. They asked after you. I'm worried about them, even more than I worry about our finances. They disturb me in a profound way. Farewell.
Farewell.
So far, there had been no hint of reaction from the princess. She hadn't even mentioned the Soulcaster. That made Shallan nervous. She wished that Yasna would just say something. The waiting was excruciating. Each day while she sat with Yasna, Shallan's stomach churned with anxiety until she was nauseated. At least, considering the killings a few days ago, Shallan had a very good excuse for looking disturbed.
Cold, calm logic. Yasna herself would be proud.
Shallan quickly gathered up the conversation she'd had with Nanbalat and burned it in the hearth. A palace maid entered a moment later, carrying a basket in the crook of her arm. She smiled at Shallan. It was time for the daily cleaning. Shallan had a strange moment of panic at seeing the woman. She wasn't one of the maids Shallan recognized. What if Yasna had sent her or someone else to search Shallan's room? Had she done so already? Shallan nodded to the woman and then, to assuage her worries, she walked to her room and closed the door. She rushed to her chest and checked the hidden compartment. The Fabriel was there. She lifted it out, inspecting it. Would she know if Yasna somehow reversed the exchange?
You're being foolish. Yasna's subtle, but she's not that subtle.
Still, Shallan stuffed the Soulcaster in her safe pouch. It just barely fit inside the envelope-like cloth container. She'd feel safer knowing she had it on her while the maid cleaned her room. Besides, the safe pouch might be a better hiding place for it than her trunk. By tradition, a woman's safe pouch was where she kept items of intimate or very precious import. To search one would be like strip-searching her. Considering her rank, either would be virtually unthinkable unless she were obviously implicated in a crime. Yasna would probably force it. But if Yasna could do that, she could order a search of Shallan's room, and her trunk would be under particular scrutiny. The truth was, if Yasna chose to suspect her, there would be little Shallan could do to hide the Fabrial. So the safe pouch was as good a place as any. She gathered up the pictures she'd drawn and put them upside down on the desk, trying not to look at them. She didn't want those to be seen by the maid. Finally, she left, taking her portfolio. She felt that she needed to get outside and escape for a while. Draw something other than death and murder. The conversation with Nan Balat had only served to upset her more.
Brightness?
Shallan froze, but the maid held up a basket.
This was dropped off for you with the master servants.
She hesitantly accepted it, looking inside. Bread and jam. A note tied to one of the jars read,
Blue bar jam. If you like it, it means you're mysterious, reserved, and thoughtful. Capsule.
Shallan placed the basket's handle in the crook of her safe arm's elbow.
Capsule. Maybe I should go find him.
She always felt better after a conversation with him.
No, I'm going to leave. I can't keep stringing him along.
Or herself. She was afraid of where the relationship was going. Instead, she made her way to the main cavern, and then to the conclave's exit. She walked out into the sunlight and looked up into the sky as servants and attendants parted around her, swarming in and out of the conclave. She held her portfolio close, feeling the cool breeze on her cheeks and the contrasting warmth of the sunlight pressing down on her hair and forehead. In the end, the most disturbing part was that Yasna had been right. Shallan's world of simple answers had been a foolish, childish place. She'd clung to the hope that she could find truth and use it to explain, perhaps justify, what she had done back in Yakaved. But if there was such a thing as truth, it was far more complicated and murky than she'd assumed. Some problems didn't seem to have any good answers, just a lot of wrong ones. She could choose the source of her guilt, but she couldn't choose to be rid of that guilt entirely. 2 hours, and about 20 quick sketches later, Shallan felt far more relaxed. She sat in the palace gardens, sketch pad in her lap, drawing snails. The gardens weren't as extensive as her father's, but they were far more varied, not to mention blessedly secluded. Like many modern gardens, they were designed with walls of cultivated shale bark. This one's made a maze of living stone. They were short enough that, when standing, she could see the way back to the entrance. But if she sat down on one of the numerous benches, she could feel alone and unseen. She'd asked a groundskeeper the name of the most prominent shale bark plant. He'd called it plated stone. A fitting name, as it grew in thin, round sections that piled atop one another like plates in a cupboard. From the sides, it looked like weathered rock that exposed hundreds of thin strata. Tiny little tendrils grew up out of pores waving in the wind. The stone-like casings had a bluish shade, but the tendrils were yellowish. Her current subject was a snail with a low horizontal shell edged with little ridges. When she tapped, it would flatten itself into a rift in the shale bark, appearing to become part of the plated stone. It blended in perfectly. When she let it move, it nibbled at the shale bark, but didn't chew it away.
It's cleaning the shale bark, eating off the lichen and mold.
Indeed, a cleaner trail extended behind it. Patches of a different kind of shale bark, with finger-like protrusions growing up into the air from a central knob, grew alongside the plated stone. When she looked closely, she noted little kremlings, thin and multi-legged, crawling along it, eating at it.
Curious. Are they cleaning it too?
She began a sketch of the miniature kremlings. They had carapaces shaded like the shale bark's fingers, while the snail's shell was a near duplicate of the yellow and blue colorings of the plated stone. It was as if they had been designed by the Almighty in pairs, the plant giving safety to the animal cleaning the plant. A few lifespren, tiny, glowing green specks floated around the shale-bark mounds. Some danced amid the rifts in the bark, others in the air like dust motes, zigzagging up only to fall again. She used a finer-tipped charcoal pencil to scribble some thoughts about the relationship between the animals and the plants. She didn't know of any books that spoke of relationships like this one. Scholars seemed to prefer studying big, dynamic animals like great shells or white spines. But this seemed a beautiful, wondrous discovery to Shallan.
Snails and plants can help one another, but I betray Yasna.
She glanced toward her safe hand in the pouch hidden inside. She felt more secure having the soul caster near. She hadn't yet dared try to use it. She'd been too nervous about the theft and had worried about using the object near Yasna. Now, however, she was in a nook deep within the maze, with only one curving entrance into her dead end. She stood up casually, looking around. No one else was in the gardens, and she was far enough inside that it would take minutes for anyone to get to her. Shallan sat back down, setting aside her drawing pad and pencil.
I might as well see if I can figure out how to use it. Maybe there's no need to keep searching the Palinaeum for a solution.
She removed the forbidden device. It was heavy in her hand, solid. She looped the chains around her fingers and around her wrist, the gemstone set against the back of her hand. The metal was cold, the chains loose. She flexed her hand, pulling the fabrial tight. She'd anticipated a feeling of power, prickles on her skin, perhaps, or a sense of strength and might. But there was nothing. She tapped the three gemstones. She'd placed her smokestone into the third setting. Some other fabrials, like spanreeds, worked when you tapped the stones. But that was foolish. She'd never seen Yasna do that. The woman just closed her eyes and touched something, soul-casting it. Smoke, crystal, and fire were what this soul-caster was best at. Only once had she seen Yasna create anything else. Hesitant, Shallan took a piece of broken shale bark from the base of one of the plants. She held it up in her free hand, then closed her eyes.
Become smoke.
Nothing happened.
Become crystal.
She cracked an eye. There was no change.
Fire. Burn. Your fire. Your...
A mysteriously burned hand?
No, that wouldn't be at all suspicious.
She focused on crystal. She closed her eyes again, holding the image of a piece of quartz in her mind. She tried to will the shale bark to change. Nothing happened, so she just tried focusing, imagining the shale bark transforming. After a few minutes of failure, she tried making the pouch change instead, then tried the bench, then tried one of her hairs. Nothing worked. Shallan checked to make certain she was still alone, then sat down, frustrated. Nan Balat had asked Luesh how the devices worked, and he'd said that it was easier to show than explain. He'd promised to give them answers if she actually managed to steal Yasna's. Now, he was dead. Was she doomed to carry this one back to her family only to immediately give it away to those dangerous men, never using it to gain wealth to protect her house? All because they didn't know how to activate it? The other fabrials she'd used had been simple to activate, but those were constructed by contemporary artifabrians. Soul casters were fabrials from ancient times. They wouldn't employ modern methods of activation. She stared at the glowing gemstone suspended on the back of her hand. How would she figure out the method of using a tool thousands of years old, one forbidden to any but Ardents? She slid the soul caster back into her safe pouch. It seemed she was back to searching the Palinaeum.
That, or asking Capsule?
But would she manage that without looking suspicious? She broke out his bread and jam, eating and thinking idly. If Capsule didn't know, and if she couldn't find the answers by the time she left Carbranth, were there other options? If she took the artifact to the Vaden King, or maybe the Ardents, might they be able to protect her family in exchange for the gift? After all, she couldn't really be blamed for stealing from a heretic, and so long as Yasna didn't know who had the soul caster, they would be safe. For some reason, that made her feel even worse. Stealing the Soulcaster to save her family was one thing, but turning it over to the very Ardens whom Yasna disdained, it seemed a greater betrayal. Yet another difficult decision.
Well then, it's a good thing Yasna is so determined to train me in how to deal with those. By the time all this is done, I should be quite the expert.
Death upon the lips, sound upon the air, char upon the skin. From The Last Desolation by Ambrian, line 335.
Kaladin stumbled into the light, shading his eyes against the burning sun, his bare feet feeling the transition from cold indoor stone to sun-warmed stone outside. The air was lightly humid, not muggy, as it had been in previous weeks. He rested his hand on the wooden door frame, his legs quivering rebelliously, his arms feeling as if he'd carried a bridge for 3 days straight. His side should have blazed with pain, but he felt only a residual soreness. Some of his deeper cuts were still scabbed over, but the smaller ones had vanished completely. His head was surprisingly clear. He didn't even have a headache. He rounded the side of the barrack, feeling stronger with each step, though he kept his hand on the wall. Lopin followed behind. The Herdazian had been watching over Kaladin when he awoke.
I should be dead. What is going on?
On the other side of the barrack, he was surprised to find the men carrying their bridge in daily practice. They reached the other side of the lumberyard and turned around, charging back. Only when they were almost past the barrack did one of the men in front, Moash, notice Kaladin. He froze, nearly causing the entire bridge crew to trip.
What is wrong with you?
Torfin's head was enveloped by the wood of the bridge. Moash didn't listen. He ducked out from under the bridge, looking at Kaladin with wide eyes.
Go!
Mor saw him, adopting the same reverent expressions as Moash. Haber and Pete, their wound sufficiently healed, had started practicing with the others. That was good. They'd be drawing pay again. The men walked up to Kaladin, silent in their leather vests. They kept their distance, hesitant, as if he were fragile or holy. Kaladin was bare-chested, his nearly healed wounds exposed, and wore only his knee-length bridgeman's trousers.
You really need to practice what to do if one of you trips or stumbles, men. When Moash stopped abruptly, you all about fell over. That could be a disaster on the field.
They stared at him, incredulous, and he couldn't help but smile. In a moment, they crowded around him, thumping him on the back. Only Teft didn't join in. The aging bridgeman stood at the side, arms folded. He seemed concerned.
Teft, you all right?
I just figure those lads don't bathe often enough for me to want to get close enough for a hug. No offense.
I understand.
His last bath had been the high storm.
The high storm.
Kaladin remembered the storm. He recalled it distinctly. Holding to the ring atop the building, his head down and eyes closed against the pelting torrent. He remembered Syl standing protectively before him as if she could turn back the storm itself. He couldn't see her about now.
Where is she?
He also remembered the face.
The Stormfather himself? Surely not. A delusion.
Yes, he'd certainly been delusional. Memories with Deathspren were blended with relived parts of his life, and both mixed with strange, sudden shocks of strength. Icy cold, but refreshing. It had been like the cold air of a crisp morning after a long night in a stuffy room, or like rubbing the sap of gulket leaves on sore muscles, making them feel warm and cold at the same time. He could remember those moments so clearly.
What caused them? The fever?
Kaladin checked over the bridgemen, counting them. 33, counting Lopin and the silent Dabid. Almost all were accounted for. Impossible. If his ribs were healed, then he must have been unconscious for 3 weeks at least.
How many bridge runs?
How long?
10 days.
Impossible. My wounds.
Is why we're so surprised to see you up and walking. You must have bones like granite. Is my name you should be having.
Kaladin leaned back against the wall. Nobody corrected Moash. The entire crew of men couldn't lose track of the weeks like that.
Edelir and Treff?
We lost them. We did 2 bridge runs while you were unconscious. Nobody badly wounded, but 2 dead. We didn't know how to help them.
That made the men grow subdued. But death was the way of bridgemen, and they couldn't afford to dwell for long on the lost. Kaladin did decide, however, that he'd need to train a few of the others in healing.
But how am I up and walking? Am I less injured than I've assumed?
Hesitantly, he prodded at his side, feeling for broken ribs.
Just a little sore.
Other than the weakness, he felt as healthy as he ever had. Perhaps he should have paid a little more attention to his mother's religious teachings. As the men turned back to talking and celebrating, he noticed the looks they gave him. Respectful, reverent. They remembered what he'd said before the high storm. Looking back, Kaladin realized he'd been a little delirious. It now seemed an incredibly arrogant proclamation, not to mention that it smelled of prophecy. If the Ardents discovered that, well, he couldn't undo what he'd done. He'd just have to continue.
You were already balancing over a chasm. Did you have to scale an even higher cliffside?
Figures.
We're on duty?
Yeah.
Line up! You know what to do! Let's show Captain Kaladin that we haven't forgotten how to do this!
Captain Kaladin?
Sure, Gancho. They tried to make Rock bridge leader, sure. But we just started calling you captain, and him squad leader made Gaz angry.
Kaladin nodded. The other men were so joyous, but he was finding it difficult to share their mood. As they formed up around their bridge, he began to realize the source of his melancholy. His men were right back where they'd started, or worse. He was weakened and injured and had offended the High Prince himself. Sadeus would not be pleased when he learned that Kaladin had survived his fever. The bridgemen were still destined to be cut down one by one. The side carry had been a failure. He hadn't saved his men. He'd just given them a short stay of execution.
Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive.
He suspected why that was. Gritting his teeth, he let go of the barrack wall and crossed to where the bridgemen stood in line, leaders of the sub-squads doing a quick check of their vests and sandals. Rock eyed Kaladin.
And what is this thing you believe you are doing?
I'm joining you.
And what would you tell one of the men if they had just gotten up from a week with the fevers?
I'm not like the other men.
He couldn't start believing himself invincible. To run now with the crew, as weak as he was, would be sheer idiocy.
You're right.
You can help me and the Muli carry water, Gancho. We're a team now. Go on every run.
All right.
Rock eyed him.
If I'm feeling too weak at the end of the permanent bridges, I'll go back. I promise.
Rock nodded reluctantly. The men marched under the bridge to the staging area, and Kaladin joined Lopin and David, filling water skins. Kaladin stood at the edge of the precipice, hands clasped behind his back, sandaled toes at the very edge of the cliff. The chasm stared up at him, but he did not meet its gaze. He was focused on the battle being waged on the next plateau. This approach had been an easy one. They'd arrived at the same time as the Parshendi. Instead of bothering to kill bridgemen, the Parshendi had taken a defensive position in the center of the plateau, around the chrysalis. Now Sadeus's men fought them. Kaladin's brow was slick with sweat from the day's heat, and he still felt a lingering exhaustion from his sickness. Yet it wasn't nearly as bad as it should have been. The surgeon's son was baffled. For the moment, the soldier overruled the surgeon. He was transfixed by the battle. A Lethi spearman in leathers and breastplates pressed a curved line against the Parshendi warriors. Most Parshendi used battle axes or hammers, though a few wielded swords or clubs. They all had that red-orange armor growing from their skin, and they fought in pairs. It was the worst kind of battle, the kind that was close. Often, you'd lose far fewer men in a skirmish where your enemies quickly gained the upper hand. When that happened, your commander would order the retreat to cut his losses. But close battles, they were brutal, blood-soaked things. Watching the fighting, The bodies dropped to the rocks, the weapons flashing, the men pushed off the plateau. Reminded him of his first fights as a spearman. His commander had been shocked at how easily Kaladin dealt with seeing blood. Kaladin's father would have been shocked at how easily Kaladin spilled it. There was a big difference between his battles in Alethkar and the fights on the Shattered Plains. There, he'd been surrounded by the worst, or at least worst-trained soldiers in Alethkar, men who didn't hold their lines. And yet, for all their disorder, those fights had made sense to him. These here on the Shattered Plains did not. That had been his miscalculation. He'd changed battlefield tactics before understanding them. He would not make that mistake again. Rock stepped up beside Kaladin, joined by Sigsel. The thick-limbed Horn-Eater made for quite a contrast to the short, quiet, Azish man. Sigsel's skin was a deep brown, not true black, like some parchments. He tended to keep to himself.
It's bad battle. The soldiers will not be happy, whether or not they win.
Why do they fight, Rock?
For money and for vengeance. You should know this thing. Is it not your king who Parshendi killed?
Oh, I understand why we fight. But the Parshendi, why do they fight?
It's because they don't very much like the idea of being beheaded for killing your king, I should think. Very unaccommodating of them.
Perhaps. But then why do they fight for the gem hearts? Their numbers are dwindling because of skirmishes like these.
You know this thing?
They raid less frequently than they used to. People talk about it in camp, and they don't strike as close to the Alethi side as they once did.
It seems logical. Ha! Perhaps we will soon win this fight and be going home.
No. He had a very formal way of speaking, with barely a hint of an accent. What language did the Azish speak, anyway? Their kingdom was so distant that Kaladin had only ever met one other.
I doubt that. And I can tell you why they fight, Kaladin.
Really?
They must have soul casters. They need the gemstones for the same reason we do, to make food.
It sounds reasonable. Just conjecture, but a reasonable one. Let me ask you something else, then. Why can't Bridgemen have shields?
Because this thing makes us too slow.
No. They could send Bridgemen with shields out in front of the bridges, running in front of us. It wouldn't slow anyone down. Yes, you would have to field more Bridgemen, but you'd save enough lives with those shields to make up for the larger roster.
Sadeus fields more of us than he needs already. In most cases, more bridges land than he needs.
But why?
Because we make good targets. We're put out in front to draw Parshendi attention.
Of course we are. Armies always do these things. The poorest and the least trained go first.
I know, but usually they're at least given some measure of protection. Don't you see? We're not just an expendable initial wave. We're bait. We're exposed so the Parshendi can't help but fire at us. It allows the regular soldiers to approach without being hurt. The Parshendi archers are aiming at the bridgemen. Shields would make us less tempting. That's why he forbids them.
Perhaps, but it seems foolish to waste troops.
Actually, it isn't foolish. If you have to repeatedly attack fortified positions, you can't afford to lose your trained troops. Don't you see? Sadeus has only a limited number of trained men, but untrained ones are easy to find. Each arrow that strikes down a bridgeman is one that doesn't hit a soldier you've spent a great deal of money outfitting and training. That's why it's better for Sadeus to field a large number of bridgemen rather than a smaller, but protected number.
He should have seen it earlier. He had been distracted by how important bridgemen were to the battles. If the bridges didn't arrive at the chasms, then the army couldn't cross. But each bridge crew was kept well stocked with bodies, and twice as many bridge crews were sent on each assault as were needed. Seeing a bridge fall must give the Parshendi a great sense of satisfaction, and they usually got to drop two or three bridges on every bad chasm run, sometimes more. So long as bridgemen were dying and the Parshendi didn't spend their time firing on soldiers, Sadeus had reason to keep the bridgemen vulnerable. The Parshendi should have seen through it, but it was very hard to turn your arrow away from the unarmored man carrying the siege equipment. The Parshendi were said to be unsophisticated fighters. Indeed, watching the battle on the other plateau, studying it, focusing, he saw that was true. Where the Alethi maintained a straight, disciplined line, each man protecting his partners, the Parshendi attacked in independent pairs. The Alethi had superior techniques and tactics. True, each of the Parshendi was superior in strength, and their skill with those axes was remarkable. But Sadius's Alethi troops were well-trained in modern formations. Once they got a foothold, and if they could prolong the battle, their discipline often saw them to victory.
The Parshendi haven't fought in large-scale battles before this war. They're used to smaller skirmishes, perhaps against other villages or clans.
Several of the other bridgemen joined Kaladin, Rock and Sigzil. Before long, the majority of them were standing there. It took another hour before the battle was won. Sadius proved victorious, but Rock was right. The soldiers were grim. They'd lost many friends this day. It was a tired, battered group of spearmen that Kaladin and the others led back to camp. A few hours later, Kaladin sat on a chunk of wood beside Bridge 4's nightly fire. Syl sat on his knee, having taken the form of a small, translucent blue and white flame. She'd come to him during the march back, spinning around gleefully to see him up and walking, but had given no explanation for her absence. Every couple of seconds, someone asked Rock if the stew was done yet, often banging on his bowl with a good-natured smack of the spoon. Rock said nothing, stirring. They all knew that nobody ate until he declared the stew finished. He was very particular about not serving inferior food. The air smelled of boiling dumplings. The men were in good spirits. Their bridge leader had survived execution, and today's bridge run hadn't cost a single casualty. Spirits were high, except for Kaladin's. He understood now. He understood just how futile their struggle was. He understood why Sadius hadn't bothered to acknowledge Kaladin's survival. He was already a bridgeman, and being a bridgeman was a death sentence. Kaladin had hoped to show Sadius that his bridge crew could be efficient and useful. He'd hoped to prove that they deserved protection, shields, armor, training. Kaladin thought that if they acted like soldiers, maybe they would be seen as soldiers. None of that would work. A bridgeman who survived was, by definition, a bridgeman who had failed. His men trusted him. He'd done the impossible, surviving the high storm, wounded, tied to a wall. Surely, he would perform another miracle, this time for them. They were good men, but they thought like foot soldiers. The officers and the light eyes would worry about the long term. The men were fed and happy, and that was enough for now. Not for Kaladin. He found himself face to face with the man he'd left behind. The one he'd abandoned that night he'd decided not to throw himself into the chasm. The man with haunted eyes. A man who had given up on caring or hoping. A walking corpse.
I'm going to fail them.
He couldn't let them continue running bridges, dying off one by one. But he also couldn't think of an alternative. And so their laughter tore at him. One of the men, Maps, stood, holding up his arms, quieting the others. It was the time between moons, and so he was lit mostly by the firelight. There was a spray of stars in the sky above. Several of those moved about, the tiny pinpricks of light chasing after one another, zipping around like distant, glowing insects. Starspren. They were rare. Maps was a flat-faced fellow, his beard bushy, his eyebrows thick. Everyone called him Maps because of the birthmark on his chest that he swore was an exact map of Alethkar, though Kaladin hadn't been able to see the resemblance.
It's a good night. A special night and all. We got our bridge leader back. We got good food coming. It is coming, ain't it, Rock?
He's coming.
You sure about that? We could go on another bridge run, give you a little extra time, you know, 5 or 6 more hours.
Rock gave him a fierce look. Maps reached to the ground behind the stone he was using for a seat. He pulled out a paper-wrapped package and tossed it to Rock. Surprised, the tall horn-eater barely caught it, nearly dropping it into the stew.
from all of us for making stew each night. Don't think we haven't noticed how hard you work on it. We relax while you cook. And you always serve everyone else first. So, we bought you something to thank you.
Rock unwrapped the package and stared into it for a long while. Kaladin leaned forward, trying to get a look at the contents. Rock reached in and held the item up. It was a straight razor of gleaming silvery steel. There was a length of wood covering the sharp side. Rock pulled this off, inspecting the blade.
You are sick fools. It's beautiful.
There's a piece of polished steel, too, for a mirror, and some beard soap and a leather strop for sharpening.
Amazingly, Rock grew teary-eyed. He turned away from the pot bearing his gifts.
Stew is ready.
Then he ran into the barrack building. The men sat quietly.
Stormfather, you think we did the right thing? I mean, the way he complains and all?
I think it was perfect, Dunny. Just give the big lad some time to recover.
Sorry we didn't get you nothing, sir. We didn't know you'd be awake and all.
It's all right.
Well, is someone going to serve that stew, or will we all just sit here hungry until it burns?
Donnie jumped up, grabbing the ladle. The men gathered around the pot, jostling one another as Donnie served. Without Rock there to snap at them and keep them in line, it was something of a melee. Only Sigzil did not join in. The quiet, dark-skinned man sat to the side, eyes reflecting the flames. Kaladin rose. He was worried, terrified, really, that he might become that wretch again, the one who had given up on caring because he saw no alternative. So he sought conversation, walking over toward Sigzil. His motion disturbed Syl, who buzzed up onto his shoulder. She still held the form of a flickering flame. Having that on his shoulder was even more distracting. He didn't say anything. If she knew it bothered him, she'd be likely to do it more. She was still a windspren, after all. Kaladin sat down next to Sigzil.
Not hungry?
They are more eager than I. If previous evenings are a reliable guide, there will still be enough for me once they have filled their bowls.
I appreciated your analysis out on the plateau today.
I am good at that sometimes.
You're educated. You speak like it and you act like it.
Yes. Among my people, it is not a sin for a male to be keen of mind.
It isn't a sin for a Lethe either.
My experience is that you care only about wars and the art of killing.
And what have you seen of us besides our army?
Not much.
So, a man of education. In a bridge crew.
My education was never completed.
Neither was mine.
Sigzil looked at him, curious.
I apprenticed as a surgeon.
Sigzil nodded, thick, dark hair falling around his shoulders. He'd been one of the only bridge men who bothered shaving. Now that Rock had a razor, maybe that would change.
A surgeon? I cannot say that is surprising, considering how you handle the wounded. The men say that you're secretly a light eyes of very high rank.
What? But my eyes are dark brown.
Pardon me, I didn't speak the right word. You don't have the right word in your language. To you, a light eyes is the same as a leader. In other kingdoms, though, other things make a man curse this Alethi language. A man of high birth. A bright lord, only without the eyes. Anyway, the men think you must have been raised outside of Alethkar as a leader. It's the way you lead so naturally, the way you make others want to listen to you. These are things they associate with light eyes, and so they have invented a past for you. You will have a difficult time disabusing them of it now, assuming it is a fabrication. I was there in the chasm the day you used that spear.
A spear? A dark-eyed soldier's weapon, not a light-eyed sword.
To many bridgemen, the difference is minimal. All are so far above us.
So what is your story?
I wondered if you were going to ask. The others mention that you have pried into their origins.
I like to know the men I lead.
And if some of us are murderers?
Then I'm in good company. If it was a light-eyes you killed, then I might buy you a drink.
not Elidi's. And he is not dead.
Then you're not a murderer.
Not for want of trying. I thought for certain I had succeeded. It was not the wisest choice I made. My master...
Is he the one you tried to kill?
No.
Kaladin waited, but no more information was forthcoming.
A scholar, or at least a man of learning. There has to be a way to use this. Find a way out of this death trap, Kaladin. Use what you have. There has to be a way.
You were right about the Bridgemen. We are sent to die. It is the only reasonable explanation. There is a place in the world, Marabethia. Have you heard of it?
No.
It is beside the sea, to the north, in the Sile lands. The people are known for their great fondness for debate. At each intersection in the city, they have small pedestals on which a man can stand and proclaim his arguments. It is said that everyone in Marabethia carries a pouch with an overripe fruit, just in case they pass a proclaimer with whom they disagree. What you said earlier on the plateau, it made me think of the Marabethians. You see, they have a curious way of treating condemned criminals. They dangle them over the seaside cliff near the city, down near the water at high tide, with a cut sliced in each cheek. There is a particular species of great shell in the depths there. The creatures are known for their succulent flavor, and of course they have gem hearts, not nearly as large as the ones in these chasm fiends, but still nice. So, the criminals, they become bait. A criminal may demand execution instead, but they say if you hang there for a week and are not eaten, then you can go free.
And does that often happen?
Never. But the prisoners almost always take the chance. The Marabethians have a saying for someone who refuses to see the truth of a situation. You have eyes of red and blue, they say. Red for the dripping blood, blue for the water. It is said that these two things are all the prisoners see. Usually, they are attacked within one day. And yet, most still wish to take that chance. They prefer the false hope.
Eyes of red and blue.
You do a good work. At first, I hated you for lying to the men, but I have come to see that a false hope makes them happy. What you do is like giving medicine to a sick man to ease his pain until he dies. Now, these men can spend their last days in laughter. You are a healer indeed, Kaladin Stormblessed.
Kaladin wanted to object, to say that it wasn't a false hope, but he couldn't. Not with his heart in his stomach, not with what he knew. A moment later, Rock burst from the barrack.
I feel like a true Aliltiki again. My friends, you cannot know what you have done. Someday I will take you to the peaks and show you the hospitality of kings.
Despite all of his complaining, he hadn't shaved his beard off completely. He had left long, red-blonde sideburns, which curved down to his chin. The tip of the chin itself was shaved clean, as were his lips. On the tall, oval-faced man, the look was quite distinctive. Rock grabbed the nearest men there and hugged them both to him, causing Bissig to nearly spill his stew.
I will make you all family for this. A peak dweller's Humaka Aban is his pride. I feel like a true man again. Here, this razor belongs not to me, but to us all. Any who wishes to use it must do so. It's my honor to share with you.
A few of the men took Rock up on the offer. Kaladin wasn't one of them. It just didn't seem to matter to him. He accepted the bowl of stew Doni brought him, but didn't eat. Sigzil chose not to sit back down beside him, retreating to the other side of the campfire.
Eyes of red and blue. I don't know if that fits us.
For him to have eyes of red and blue, Kaladin would have to believe that there was at least a small chance the bridge crew could survive. This night, Kaladin had trouble convincing himself. He'd never been an optimist. He saw the world as it was, or he tried to. That was a problem, though, when the truth he saw was so terrible.
Oh, still I'm father. I'm falling back to what I was. I'm losing my grip on this, on myself.
He couldn't carry the hopes of all the Bridgemen. He just wasn't strong enough. Five and a half years ago, Kaladin pushed past Laryl and stumbled into the surgery room. Even after years working with his father, the amount of blood in the room was shocking. It was as if someone had dumped out a bucket of bright red paint. The scent of burned flesh hung in the air. Liren worked frantically on Bright Lord Riller, Rishun's son. An evil-looking tusk-like thing jutted from the young man's abdomen, and his lower right leg was crushed. It hung by only a few tendons, splinters of bone poking out like reeds from the waters of a pond. Bright Lord Rishun himself lay on the side table, eyes squeezed shut as he held his leg, which was pierced by another of the bony spears. Blood leaked from his improvised bandage, flowed down the side of the table, and dripped to the floor to mix with his son's. Kaladin stood in the doorway, gaping. Laryl clutched the doorframe as several of Rishun's guards tried to pull her away.
Do something! Work harder! He can't! He was where it happened, and I don't care! Let me go!
The guards finally got her away.
Kaladin, I need you!
Shocked into motion, Kaladin entered the room, scrubbing his hands, then gathering bandages from the cabinet, stepping in blood. He caught a glimpse of Riller's face. Much of the skin on the right side had been scraped off. The eyelid was gone. The blue eye itself, sliced open at the front, deflated like the skin of a grape pressed for wine. Kaladin hastened to his father with the bandages. His mother appeared at the doorway a moment later, Tien behind her. She raised a hand to her mouth, then pulled Tien away. He stumbled, looking woozy. She returned in a moment without him.
Water, Kaladin! Asena, fetch more, quickly!
His mother jumped to help, though she rarely assisted in the surgery anymore. Her hands shook as she grabbed one of the buckets and ran outside. Kaladin took the other bucket, which was full, to his father as Liren eased the length of bone from the young light-eyed gut. Riller's remaining eye fluttered, head quivering.
What is that?
Kaladin pressed the bandage to the wound as his father tossed the strange object aside.
White spine tusk. Water!
Kaladin grabbed a sponge, dunked it in the bucket, and used it to squeeze water into Riller's gut wound. That washed away the blood, giving Liren a good look at the damage. He quested with his fingers as Kaladin got some needle and thread ready. There was already a tourniquet on the leg. Full amputation would come later. Liren hesitated, fingers inside the gaping hole in Riller's belly. Kaladin cleaned the wound again. He looked up at his father, concerned. Liren pulled his fingers out and walked to Bright Lord Rishun.
Bandages, Kaladin!
Kaladin hurried over, though he shot a look over his shoulder at Riller. The once handsome young light eyes trembled again, spasming.
Father!
Bandages! What are you doing, surgeon? What of my son?
Pain spread swarmed around him.
Your son is dead.
Liren yanked the tusk free from Rishun's leg. Rishun clenched his jaw as Kaladin pressed the bandage down on his leg. Liren dunked his hands in the water bucket, then quickly wiped them with knobweed sap to frighten off Rotspren.
My son is not dead. I can see him moving. Tend to him, surgeon!
Kaladin, get the day's water.
Kaladin hurried to the back of the room and threw open the far cupboard. He took out a small flask of clear liquid.
What are you doing? Look at my son! Almighty above, would you look at him?
Kaladin turned hesitantly, pausing as he poured day's water on a bandage. Riller was spasming more violently.
I work under these guidelines, Rishun. The guidelines every surgeon uses when choosing between two patients. If the wounds are equal, treat the youngest first.
Then see to my son!
If the wounds are not equally threatening, treat the worst wound first.
As I've been telling you!
The third guideline supersedes them both, Rishun. A surgeon must know when someone is beyond their ability to help. I'm sorry, Rishun. I would save him if I could, I promise you. But I cannot.
No!
Rishun struggled violently.
Kaladin, quickly!
Kaladin dashed over. He pressed the bandage of Dayswater to Rishun's chin and mouth, just below the nose, forcing the light-eyed man to breathe the fumes. The two of them held him down, and he was weak from blood loss. Soon, he finally passed out. Liren turned back to the leg wound while Kaladin went to throw away the Dayswater bandage.
No. Administer it to Riller. It's the only mercy we can give him.
Kaladin nodded and used the Dayswater bandage on the wounded youth. Riller didn't seem conscious enough to notice the effects. Then, Kaladin threw the bandage with the Dayswater into the brazier. Heat negated the effects. Kaladin returned with a sponge and washed down Rishun's wound as Liren prodded at it. There were a few shards of tusk trapped inside, and Liren got out his tongs and razor-sharp knife.
Damnation can take them all.
Liren pulled out the first sliver of tusk.
Isn't sending half of us to war enough for them? Do they have to seek death even when they're living in a quiet township? Rishun should never have gone looking for the storming Whitespine.
He was looking for it?
They went hunting it. Wistio and I used to joke about light eyes like them. If you can't kill men, you kill beasts. Well, this is what you found, Rishun.
Father, he's not going to be pleased with you when he awakes.
Liren didn't respond. He yanked out another fragment of tusk, and Kaladin washed out the wound. His father pressed his fingers to the side of the large puncture, inspecting it. There was one more sliver of tusk jutting from a muscle inside the wound. Right beside that muscle thumped the femoral artery, the largest in the leg. Liren reached in with his knife, carefully cutting free the sliver of tusk. Then he paused for a moment, the edge of his blade just hairs from the artery.
If that were cut, Rishun would be dead in minutes.
He was only alive right now because the tusk had missed the artery. Liren's normally steady hand quivered. Then he glanced up at Kaladin. He withdrew the knife without touching the artery, then reached in with his tongs to pull the sliver free. He tossed it aside, then calmly reached for his thread and needle. Behind them, Riller had stopped breathing. That evening, Kaladin sat on the steps to his house, hands in his lap. Rishun had been returned to his estate to be cared for by his personal servants. His son's corpse was cooling in the crypt below, and a messenger had been sent to request a soul caster for the body. On the horizon, the sun was red as blood. Everywhere Kaladin looked, the world was red. The door to the surgery closed, and his father, looking as exhausted as Kaladin felt, tottered out. He eased himself down beside Kaladin, looking at the sun. Did it look like blood to him, too? They didn't speak as the sun slowly sank before them. Why was it most colorful when it was about to vanish for the night? Was it angry at being forced below the horizon? Or was it a showman giving a performance before retiring? Why was the most colorful part of people's bodies, the brightness of their blood, hidden beneath the skin, never to be seen unless something went wrong?
No, the blood isn't the most colorful part of a body. The eyes can be colorful too. The blood and the eyes, both representations of one's heritage and one's nobility. I saw inside a man today.
Not for the first time, and certainly not for the last. I'm proud of you. I expected to find you here crying, as you usually do when we lose a patient. You're learning.
When I said I saw inside a man, I wasn't talking about the wounds.
I see.
You would have let him die if I hadn't been there, wouldn't you? Why didn't you? It would have solved so much.
It wouldn't have been letting him die. It would have been murdering him.
You could have just let him bleed, then claimed you couldn't save him. Nobody would have questioned you. You could have done it.
No, I couldn't have.
But why?
Because I'm not a killer, son. Somebody has to start. Somebody has to step forward and do what is right because it is right. If nobody starts, then others cannot follow. The Light Eyes do their best to kill themselves and to kill us. The others still haven't brought back Alls and Milp. Rishun just left them there.
Alds and Milp, two townsmen, had been on the hunt but hadn't returned with a party bearing the two wounded Light Eyes. Rishun had been so worried about Riller that he left them behind so he could travel quickly.
The Light Eyes don't care about life, so I must. That's another reason why I wouldn't have let Rishun die, even if you hadn't been there. Though, looking at you did strengthen me.
I wish it hadn't.
You mustn't say such things.
Why not?
Because, son, we have to be better than they are. You should sleep. I may need you when the others return with Alds and Milp.
That wasn't likely. The two townsmen were probably dead by now. Their wounds were said to be pretty bad. Plus, the White Spines were still out there. Liren stood and went inside, but didn't compel Kaladin to follow.
Would I have let him die? Maybe even flick that knife to hasten him on his way?
Rishun had been nothing but a blight since his arrival, but did that justify killing him?
No. Cutting that artery wouldn't have been justified.
But what obligation had Kaladin to help? Withholding his aid wasn't the same as killing. It just wasn't. Kaladin thought it through a dozen different ways, pondering his father's words. What he found shocked him.
I honestly would have let Rishun die on that table. It would be better for my family. It would be better for the entire town.
Kaladin's father had once laughed at his son's desire to go to war. Indeed, now that Kaladin had decided he would become a surgeon on his own terms, his thoughts and actions of earlier years felt childish to him. But Liren thought Kaladin incapable of killing.
You can hardly step on a Kremlin without feeling guilty, son. Ramming your spear into a man would be nowhere near as easy as you seem to think.
But his father was wrong. It was a stunning, frightening revelation. This wasn't idle fancy or daydreaming about the glory of battle. This was real. In that moment, Kaladin knew he could kill if he needed to.
Some people, like a festering finger or a leg shattered beyond repair, just need to be removed.